Nacho Land Podcast with David Amoyal.
Benvenuti, as we would say in Italy. Welcome to all of you that don't speak Italian. Thank you so much for joining us for the Friday episode of the Calcio Land podcast. So it's awesome to be back. We took a week off on the platforms available to everyone. I was in Europe, had a great time. It was my first time heading back to Europe in 2.5 years. Had a blast, was a little bit in London, and then finally headed back to Italy, which was great. So I want to dedicate to this episode today to my dear friend Alberto, who's turning 45 today. I spent a lot of time with him in Italy. You know, I'm blessed to still be close with quite a few friends that I grew up with. I always think of the movie Stand By Me when they say the best friends you'll ever have in life are the ones you have when you're 11, 12 years old. And I've been lucky enough to have a few of those still in my life today. So happy birthday, Alberto. A lot of the stories on ultra culture that you've heard on the podcast over the years have come from him. So today we're going to get back to work. We have two great guests. Usually we go to Italy. Today I had two guests based in the US to change it up a little bit. I wanted to talk about the two clubs in Rome even before I went on vacation. So we're making up for it today, which works out perfectly since the derby is coming this weekend. So for Roma, we have our friend Steve Sciavillo from Chiesa di Totti. And for the Lazio side of things, we have our friend Sean McIntosh, who is also the chief fan officer for the new MLS team. So I think you'll really enjoy learning about that. It's also a pretty cool life story. And then at the end of the show, I did see the Batman last night. I have quite a few thoughts on that. So we'll get to that as well, since there is Serie A this weekend. We, of course, have Thousand Names, who is ready with his game picks. But before we get to all that, I am very excited to be reunited with my dear friend Alex Goldberg. It's been very busy in his neck of the woods. We're actually recording this right after the Champions League draw. So Alex Boy Benzema is squaring off against Chelsea. So, Alex, I got to ask you this. Speaking of the Champions League draw, you had Juve in your group. You obviously follow Serie A and chat with us every Friday. So I want to ask you this. How surprised were you that Juve were eliminated by Villarreal after you saw them in the group stage this season?
You know, I really am not overall that surprised, David. But maybe I'm surprised that Villarreal were able to not just get past them, but in the end, I mean, kind of spank them there at the end, saying, we're not just going to squeak by you. Actually, we're going to just fully, fully get by you. And winning 3-0 in a singular game, right, away to Juve, that used to be unheard of not that long ago against a Juve. Like, that was extremely difficult to do. So I think my main surprise, David, comes from the fact that I'm not surprised, if that makes any sense. Like, I'm surprised that I'm not that surprised by Juve not just getting eliminated from the Champions League, but Juve getting eliminated from the Champions League by Villarreal, where in the second leg, Villarreal beat them 3-0 away. Like, that is surprising. And I know a lot of the team has changed, absolutely, but this is the thing where, you know, it definitely is unfortunate for Juventus. Even in bringing back Max Allegri, the whole, well, we keep a tradition, we keep an aura, we keep a culture here, it's not shining through. Where, and I will parallel it quickly to Chelsea, right? Now, Chelsea are blessed in having Thomas Tuchel, but Chelsea, as we know, are going through a huge ownership change. And hey, we haven't seen what life is like with new ownership, and we will see. And I'm not at all guaranteeing success, but I feel a lot more comfortable about how Chelsea will transition, because I really do believe there's a culture of winning. There's a culture of competitiveness. You know, we have all of these ex-legends around who are kind of like pushing the youngsters and the academy, and it's very cohesive. And I'm not saying that Juve doesn't have that, but I feel like even Juve fans might agree, like, yeah, we have just kind of lost our way in the last few years, and we're no longer this team that people really fear. And David, that would make a lot of sense to me had a complete stranger manager come in this season, but that's not the case. So bringing back Max Allegri was nothing that brought back the culture. And you have Vlahovic here, who's, yeah, new to the team, but he is still a player that the old Juve, right, would be absolutely blessed to have. Yeah, they had some stars themselves, but, you know, that is definitely a quality player to the point where he could hang with the best Juve version in the Scudetto reign. And, yeah, the rest of the team is really still not nearly as good, but where there's a will, there's a way. And I feel like a team that kind of feels like they're still that tough team to beat. Like Thomas Tuchel says he wants to build a team that no one wants to play against. David, that used to be Juve. Like that not that long ago used to be Juve. They were not fun to play. They would really grit it out. That's not them anymore. That's not them. So my main surprise, David, comes from that I'm not surprised. Like, I am not surprised. Now, obviously, when I was kind of watching it out of the corner of my eye, Chelsea had my full attention. But, you know, I kept getting updated. I did a little double box for a second, but I kept getting updated by the commentator about how, you know, the score was changing. I was like, whoa, another? So, like, in the moment, it's a little surprising. But when you take a step back from it and you kind of think about what Juve are these days, do they put fear in other teams like they used to? The answer is unequivocally no, they don't. And that, I guess, above all, is most surprising. All right, so David, what do you think about Juve's elimination? What do you think it says about Italian football in Europe?
Yeah, and before I answer this, you know, I always like to say, if there's a bias that I'm aware of, I'm going to tell you up front. I think anyone who's listened to the pod for years knows that Andrea Agnelli is certainly not amongst my favorites. So if it comes off a little bit too critical, maybe it comes from there. But I'm going to try to be a little bit fair. So first off, on the scoreline, I do agree, was really surprising, but that it was 3-0. But I found it incredibly ironic that felt in a very weird way like an Allegri win for Villarreal. The scoreline, granted, was bigger, but Juve played really well for a while. I thought in the first half especially, I had tweeted that they created more chances in the first half than they would in like 3 weeks in Serie A. We've seen how many games, like Sampdoria, Milan, like barely any shots. And they did pretty well there. And then it totally fell apart at the end. I thought even, you know, De Ligt giving up another penalty on a handball, you could say, well, okay, this kept happening again. But if you watch that, he really kind of avoided a sure goal. So it was kind of a corto muso loss the other way in a weird way. So as far as like, and a lot has been made about the failures of Italian football in the Champions League. And I think part of it had to do with Juve being the last one playing. They got as far as Inter, so they were the last one to be eliminated. So you could kind of say, okay, no Italian team made it past the round of 16. But I do look at Juve a little bit differently than the rest of Serie A. Like maybe Inter deserves to be close to Juve's category because they have a big payroll. But look, Inter had just gone back to the Champions League a few years ago. Spalletti brought them back. We know with Conte, it was never a huge priority. I think the fact that Inter got out of the group and actually did pretty well against Liverpool, that's a very successful campaign for them. But for Juve, to me, it's a very poor loss. Now, Juve will tell you, and Arriva Bene, their executive director, had an interview where he said, well, look, our objective was to at least get out of the round, the group stage, make some revenue and get to the round of 16. Okay, fair. The problem is they've been eliminated for 3 years in a row against a team where they were the clear favorite going in. Lyon, Porto, Villarreal. Each time when the draw happened, Juve fans in general were like, oh, this is a favorable draw to Juve. To me, those are three teams you have to eliminate. If you want to be even more cynical, you could point out that the year before, they even got pretty lucky getting Ajax when they made to the quarterfinals. So to me, these eliminations against these teams really burn because we know Juve, the president, Agnelli in particular, I'm not talking the fans, has very often said, well, you know, the financial gap with the Premier League and the super rich clubs is what's preventing Juve from competing. Okay. Well, you need to get past the teams with much lower revenues than you and lower payrolls. Like Villarreal has a payroll about a third of Juve's. Lyon, Porto, Villarreal have nowhere near as close as revenues to Juve. So if you're using the financial argument for the Champions League, okay, that only goes so far. It's like if you were beating up on these teams better than you, then to me it would come off like you have a much better case to say, well, it's finances getting in the way for us getting to the next level. But the other thing that I think is really important on the Juve side is I don't think this is really that big of a deal that they were eliminated in the Champions League. Look, we've done this pod. We've been covering the season for a very long time. We were talking as if making even the top four for Juve was, I'm not going to say it was far-fetched, but it was very far from a given. So I hear you. I would have expected a little bit more from Allegri in the Champions League. He has at least got them back on track in Serie A. So I get Juve fans upset over this elimination. And again, 3 years in a row, you lose to a team that's a clear underdog to you. You got to do better. But in the grand scheme of things, you know, and I know there's a lot of comparisons to Allegri, Pirlo, and whatnot, I do think it's also important to highlight the fact that it wasn't long ago that, you know, we didn't know if Juve was going to finish top four. Now I think, I'm not saying it's automatic, but I'd be pretty surprised if they didn't do that. So those are my thoughts on that. Let's switch gears on Donnarumma, who has been linked to Juve, and I know you're up against Real Madrid next. He was in the headlines with the Benzema goal. So I want to ask you this, more big picture, PSG eliminated in the round of 16. I remember Fabrizio's tweet on the PSG summer's transfer window when you saw all the additions together and how it felt like almost surreal, and it really was in a way. And look, man, that has been a real bust. Like, in a way, it kind of reminds me of when the Lakers got Dwight Howard and Steve Nash, and they had the Sports Illustrated cover. So I want to ask you this, Alex. We've talked a ton about Lukaku's struggles at Chelsea. Both you and I fully expected him to do well there. But what has surprised you more, Lukaku's struggles at Chelsea or the fact that PSG's pharaonic transfer window has turned out to be a total bust?
Lukaku struggles at Chelsea. Normally, I mean, this is still a great question, but normally the questions you ask take me a little bit longer to decide my answer for. But yeah, definitely Lukaku struggles at Chelsea because, David, I and many called PSG failing the minute they got Messi. Like, the minute, as the kids would say, I have the receipts on Twitter to show you. I got multiple. The minute they signed Messi, the minute they just went crazy and they got even smaller players like Wijnaldum. It was so obvious. It was so painfully obvious. They weren't going to win the Champions League. First of all, I talk about aura and culture. They don't have it. They don't have it. And if they want to win their first Champions League, build a team. Build a freaking team. Don't just throw names on a paper. That's absolutely ridiculous. Like, do you not learn? And I'm not saying, well, yeah, I'm actually saying this specifically to PSG, but I'm also saying it to all teams. Like, do you not learn? LeBron, over in Los Angeles, you've won a few, right? Did you think this was going to work? It's just names. Carmelo Anthony, Russell Westbrook, Dwight Howard. Like, that's never going to work. PSG, that was never going to work. Never. And I know someone could chat to me and say, well, like, Sergio Ramos has not been fit a lot and he would help. Yeah, he would have helped. They still wouldn't have won. No way. It doesn't work. Too many names. Not big enough team. It isn't. And Pochettino is a bit of a fraud, by the way. That's just a side note. Like, a bit of a fraud. Decent manager, but not the guy that people thought he was. Or Spurs have just kind of, like, carried with him to Paris. One or the other. And then on the Lukaku thing, now it's kind of crystal clear to me, David, and to so many. Like, clearly, since Lukaku's been benched, and credit to Tuchel, he's benched Lukaku a lot now, and maybe actually Tuchel's been benefited by all the ownership drama where no one's talking about the fact Lukaku has only started one out of the last seven games. Like, he's a legitimate bench player now. But it's been so obvious since that's kind of happened and Kai Havertz has been playing that the way Kai Havertz is playing in this system at striker is never the way that Lukaku was going to play. Just never the way. So it now is not that surprising, but it was surprising for a while, David, because even if Lukaku wasn't this perfect fit in Chelsea's system, which clearly he wasn't, I thought he was just too good. And I thought coming back to Chelsea, those two factors would kind of push him over the edge to still be at least a very good goal scorer for Chelsea. So yeah, him struggling at Chelsea is more surprising to me, at least, than PSG having a total flop of a season they're not going to win the Champions League until they build differently. You know, they can put the Jordan brand all over their clothes as much as they want and hope that just by wearing Michael Jordan, they're going to start winning championships. But I'm sorry, you actually have to act like Michael Jordan. And by the way, quick thing, credit to Mbappe. And I have nothing against Messi, absolutely nothing against Messi. I mean, you know, I definitely think he's the most gifted player we've ever seen in the game. You know, greatest is a different conversation. But, David, how does it look when you have Neymar, Messi, and Mbappe, right? And one of them didn't want to be there, Mbappe, right? He was the one who ideally wanted to move last summer to Real Madrid. And for both legs, he's the only one of the three that actually showed up. Neymar and Messi were nowhere to be found, especially in the second leg when their team needed them. Like, especially, Mbappe was the one who showed up, the one who wants to leave, the one who wants to leave to the opposition. And he was still the one that showed up. So, like, I don't know if it's a passing of the torch. Maybe the torch has already been passed. Mbappe could be the best player in the world right now. I wouldn't really be able to argue against that. But still, does Brady let that happen? I know it's a completely different sport, but... does Brady, does Ronaldo even let that happen? I don't know. That's poor from Neymar and Messi, but I digress. Yeah, for me at least, it was more surprising that Lukaku struggled. So, yeah, David, you know, specifically though on Donnarumma, who didn't look too good, did he? And it's an absolute joke, by the way, that Edouard Mendy did not get on that FIFA Pro team over Donnarumma. I know he got the individual award. And I know I have a lot of Serie A fans listening right now, but come on, be objective. Mendy is a better keeper right now than Donnarumma. Anyway, do you see Donnarumma heading back to Serie A, David?
Yeah, like I got a lot of thoughts on that. And first off, on Donnarumma, yeah, that was poor. But having been a keeper myself, nowhere near at his level, I will tell you that it's really true. That's one position where a guy needs to be the starter, period. This whole back and forth is bad. But guess what? That's on him and on his agent, too, for ending up there in a place where they already had a great keeper. So, look, do I think there's a good chance Donnarumma is going to be back in Serie A? I do. And, you know, if you ask me what's more likely by the end of next year, so we get a couple of transfer windows, that Donnarumma's still at PSG or he's in Serie A and probably at Juve, I would say it's more likely that he's going to be in Serie A at Juve. And I know right away some people will say, oh, PSG doesn't really sell players. Well, they did sell Matuidi to Juve, and guess who the agent was in that deal? So I do think there's a pretty good chance that will happen. And Giuseppe Pastore, who we had on the pod not that long ago, the king of the Serie A stats, he made a great point. You know how Raiola very often compares his players to paintings or painters, and Gazzetta dello Sport had this big thing on Donnarumma as a painting, and he's going to come back to Italy. And Giuseppe made a great point, and he's like, this is just the perfect analogy that Raiola's kind of trading almost these inanimate, beautiful objects with big value, kind of like that, without the objects themselves having much say in the matter. Now, have there been exceptions? Yes, Juve fans can point to Nedved going to Serie B. So it does happen, but in general, we have a lot of that. But I'll tell you, if Donnarumma sold to a Serie A team, it really goes to show how crazy the transfer market has become. Because look at it this way. If Milan ends up having nothing, which they did, they had nothing to show for Donnarumma leaving, a player they developed, they had the courage to launch at 16 years old as a starter. They did a ton to develop them. They have nothing to show for if he goes to PSG, and then PSG sells him for a plusvalenza, and if by then we have FFP back and it helps him for FFP. Like, to me, that's really adding insult to injury. Like, great for Milan that they moved on so well without him. And look, if you're Donnarumma, man, think about this. You know, you have this elimination in the Champions League. He leaves saying, oh, you know, I'm leaving Milan because I want to go to a place with bigger ambitions. And Milan are right in the thick of things to win the Scudetto. And I'm almost, you know, I've been riding thinking that Inter is going to win. Almost starting to change my mind and say that if put a gun to my head, I'm going to take Milan. So think about that for him on that side. But then I think more big picture, the idea of this market getting really crazy. Like we were talking about Lukaku a second ago. The flip side, if Lukaku comes back to Serie A, is at least Inter got a huge return for him, which makes it harder for them to get him back unless it's on loan. Milan, on the, and they had Lukaku just two seasons. Milan, on the other hand, developed, you know, Donnarumma and have nothing to show. And think about that. I mean, the transfer to PSG made Raiola rich. If PSG sells him, it won't make him rich, but they'll get some money. That money's reinvested in the system. If PSG gets a transfer fee for Donnarumma, they can buy someone else. His transfer to PSG, the money just went in the agent's pocket. And think about the long-term implications for the market there. Before we get to 1,000 names, I have to ask you real fast, Alex, what does Tomori need to do to make the England's national team? I don't follow as much, but are the center backs on England that are on the squad, are they as good as Koulibaly and Skriniar? Is that why he's not on the team?
David, have you ever seen Harry Maguire play football these days?
Yeah, I have.
Harry Maguire, you know, you see this joke on Twitter every once in a while when like a player who is starting and no one in the fan base knows, you'll see like they must have something on the manager. Harry Maguire must have something on Gareth Southgate. Like he must, and Tyrone Mings for that matter as well. But Kayo Tomori, you ask, what does he need to do to get called up to England? Probably has to go back to England. Like, it's so sad that Gareth Southgate can't look at another league. Like, he looks at another league for Tammy Abraham, the same damn league. But because Harry Maguire is Manchester United captain, he just gets this call up to England because of that. And that is blasphemous. Like, Fikayo Tomori is 10 times the player right now than Harry Maguire is. And honestly, Tyrone Mings is just not that great at all either. It's ridiculous. And I think to anger AC Milan fans even more, if they wanted Fikayo to get that call-up, someone who is deserving of the call-up is by the name of Mark Guehi for Crystal Palace. And, of course, he's another Cobham guy, like literally just another Cobham center back like Fikayo Tomori. And he just got the call-up, his first ever call-up. And this is his first season in the Premier League, right? He's 21 years old. He's playing with Conor Gallagher, who also is a Chelsea kid, and Gallagher's now got a couple straight call-ups for England. But Fikayo Tomori's been in senior football for a handful of years now. So Guehi deserves the call-up. But David, this perfectly shows kind of Southgate will give you a much better chance if you're doing it in the Premier League. But that's just wrong. So Guehi deserves it. He's been a standout center back in the Premier League this season. But Fikayo Tomori also has done that. He's also played in the Premier League before, and now he's a standout center back in Serie A. And it's just like Harry Maguire is getting away with highway robbery. If you're feeling athletic, David, on one of the days where maybe you know you're not sore, you just had a good workout in the gym, I guarantee you, you're going to put out a better performance at this point than Harry Maguire. I mean, he's like the center back Marcos Alonso athleticism-wise, which is really saying something. So it's
not a compliment
no,
from you.
It's not. So Harry Maguire, I don't think anybody is stealing a living more at a top level than Harry Maguire right now in football. And by the way, I feel a little bit bad for him. Like, you know, I only say this here on this podcast. Like, I don't even tweet about Harry Maguire because everyone else is. And he's the Manchester United captain. And I almost think that someone has to strip that away from him. I don't think he's going to, like, take that away from himself. I don't think people really do that. You know, and then he'll get a whole bunch of other sticks saying, wow, like, he gave up his own captaincy and stuff like that. You know, he didn't show any grit or any balls. But, like, someone has to give that man a couple months off because from being an £80 million signing from Leicester City to Manchester United and now being the captain of one of the most dysfunctional, very L.A. Lakers-type team, United themselves, you know, he's not going to find his feet again or probably, like, calmness for a while. So, yeah, Fikayo Tomori, the whole world feels bad for you that's paying attention.
Yeah.
It sucks.
Yeah, huge fan. He had a great interview today in Gazzetta dello Sport. Like everything about him. All right, let's get to 1,000 names. Who last week took a week off since I was in Italy. He's back with a vengeance. So as usual, I ask him to pick three games. I don't know which ones they are. He sends them to me. I read them in English and Italian, often for the first time on the pod, which can be dangerous. And then I make my prediction as well. First up, Napoli hosting Udinese. A thousand names has Napoli winning 2-0. Goals by Zielinski and Elmas. He says Spalletti is going to gift the fans another magical night after Villarreal's win against Juve. He says they're going to show on the big screen a video conference between Albiol, who plays for Villarreal, and President De Laurentiis, where they just make fun of Agnelli and Allegri. In Italian, Napoli Udinese 2-0. Zielinski, Elmas, Spalletti regala un'altra notte magica ai tifosi dopo la vittoria del Villarreal. Videoconferenza tra Albiol e De Laurenti sugli schermi, prendono per il culo Agnelli and Allegri. Now, I didn't lead him and ask him to do this one, by the way. Napoli, very interesting, man, because they actually, to me, they still are very much into the mix for the Scudetto, because they tend to beat up on the Udineses of the world. And I'll tell you, if they win the Scudetto while getting just 1 point at home against Milan and Inter in such a crazy season, it puts this season really over the top on its randomness. I'm going to agree that Napoli are going to beat Udinese. I'm going to ride our boy Osimhen. My thing is, I think people forgot how good he is between the injury and Vlahovic's transfer to Juve. I still don't think it's out of the question that by the end of the season, he's the player in Serie A with the highest value on the transfer market, which was my prediction at the top. So I'm going to go 2 goals for Osimhen, and I'll agree. I'll give Zielinski another one. So 3-0 Napoli. Next up, Milan Cagliari. I'm going to try to hit this up with my friends at the Milan Club. Boston at Ducali, always a great time if you're looking for a place to watch Serie A. In Boston, 1,000 has Milan winning 3-0. 2 goals by Giroud, good for over-unders, Alex, and a goal by Calabria. This time it's Maignan who's going to save a penalty. Last time, 1,000 had Maignan getting a red card and Tomori saving it. This time it's Maignan. He says Pioli is going to continue his march towards the Scudetto, although Messias is ridiculous. And he says Mazzarri is going to go down in the abyss and see relegation. Look, Mazzarri has done a pretty good job getting Cagliari out of the weeds. So let's see what happens. Now, Milan did beat Empoli. I think the fact that they have a pretty soft schedule may not totally play to their advantage, because they tend to struggle a bit more when teams that close defensively. But I'm feeling pretty optimistic for Milan. So I'm going to have them winning 1-0. And I'll give, though, a goal to Leao. Final game, Bologna-Atalanta. That's the game on Sunday afternoon. 1,000 has Atalanta winning 2-0 with a brace by Muriel. He says Pasalic is going to miss a penalty. Gasperini is getting closer to fourth place. Sinisa, that's Mihailovic, is already on vacation, and that he can already feel Pirlo's breath, although there's been reports that Gattuso could be the manager at Bologna. And then he says Toloi deserves to be a starter for Italy. He sent me this before Toloi. So I think he suffered an injury yesterday, the Atalanta match. In Italian, Bologna-Atalanta 0-2, Muriel doppietta, Pasalic sbaglia rigore, Gasperini si avvicina al quarto posto, Sinisa già in vacanza, sente il fiato di Pirlo sul collo, Toloi merita di essere titolare in nazionale. Interestingly, on Atalanta, there's reports that sporting director Sartori, and he's been great at discovering players on his way out. It sounds like Gasperini, another guy he had issues with, and I saw on Gazzetta they're saying Sartori could head to Juve, which would be really interesting. Like, Juve does say that they want to be more financially responsible. Maybe they didn't really show this in the January transfer window, so that would be a pretty interesting move. Keep in mind too, Gasperini has ties to Juve. He coached their Primavera, so he kicks out Sartori, and if Sartori ends up at Juve, that would be intriguing. But I digress. I do want to pick Atalanta, but they've really stunk it up against these teams where you expect them to win. It's been really an uneven season for them. So I'm going to go 0-0 on this one, which is also their last score. So as always, thank you so much, Thousand. I think I'm going to have him on the pod as we get into the stretch run of the season to have him do some live predictions for the season. So be on the lookout for that. It's always a great time when he's on. Okay, so let's start covering the derby now. We're going to start with the Roma side of things. We're going to go to our dear friend Steve Sciavillo from Chiesa di Totti.
very excited to welcome the next guest. It's been way too long since we chatted about Roma on the podcast. So with the derby coming up, I figured we'd make up for that. So we have a great guest. We have Steve Sciavilla from Chiesa di Totti. We've had him on quite a few times. For those of you not familiar with Chiesa di Totti, it's a great Roma blog. They also have an excellent podcast. And you can also hear Steve is also on the Kicks and Kicks pod, which focuses both on the Premier League and Serie A with a little betting angle as well. So, Steve, it's always a pleasure to chat with you. Bentornato to Calcioland.
Yeah, thanks for having me back, David. Happy to be back. I know it's been a little while since we talked Roma.
Oh, for sure. For sure. So, Steve, I've been asking this question to our guests going into the final stretch on the teams they cover. So I'm going to ask you this. If you could pick one word to describe Roma's season so far, what would it be and why?
I'd have to say frustrating. And not because I expected Roma to be world beaters this year. You know, Mourinho coming in certainly, I think, raised people's expectations just a bit. But you still have to, you know, deal with a squad that certainly had some flaws. But I think the most frustrating part for me has been when you see all the teams around Roma and just above them in the table haven't been that great either, including Juventus, who, you know, they blew a match to not too long ago at the beginning of the 2022 calendar year. They were up 3-1, ended up losing 4-3. You know, they win that match and they're within a couple points of fourth place. I think to me, that's the most frustrating part. You know, is Roma a Champions League caliber, you know, qualifying team most seasons? No way. You know, they've been very inconsistent, which is probably the second word that comes to mind. But it's certainly frustrating when you don't take advantage of other teams' mistakes. And Roma hasn't done that this season. You know, it's that to me is what makes it so frustrating.
Yeah, you know, that's very well put. Because, you know, the case could be made is that Roma has a better squad than last season. And I guess that's a little bit more debatable. But I think what's not debatable is Serie A as a whole is just not as strong. So I can see why you feel that way. It's almost like a missed opportunity. So let's talk a little bit about Mourinho. I'm just going to ask you this. What do you think has been the biggest difference between Fonseca's Roma and Mourinho's Roma so far?
Can I say the press conferences?
sure.
No, all joking aside, certainly a different, you know, personality on the touchline. Certainly a much more fiery guy. He's created that siege mentality. You know, they always talk about the mentality with Mourinho's teams and he's going to try to create that, you know, winning mentality with inside, which he's trying to do, obviously. You know, he's taking the Conference League seriously, which a lot of people, including myself early on, were like, we don't really need the Conference League because it just, you know, it's going to fatigue us for the league, which it has. But, you know, if they can go on and win that, certainly that'll help hopefully build something more next season if he's around for the full 3 years after that in terms of winning, because Roma hasn't done any winning in a long time, you know, besides coming close in the Champions League a few years ago and finishing behind that historic Juve by, I believe it was 4 points under Spalletti. They haven't come close to a trophy or, of any sort in a while. So certainly he's trying to do that. And I think we're starting to see a slight change in the mentality the past couple months. You know, Roma just this past weekend had to really fight hard against an Udinese side that was really stubborn, got a late tying goal. The result against Spezia came late in the game, you know, both on penalty kicks, granted, but I don't know if the Roma of Fonseca would have done that. I feel like they shut down mentally more easily when they gave up, you know, a lead early. And this Roma side under Mourinho certainly has given up plenty of early goals, but maybe not back down as easily or given in as easily, which I think has started to change ever since that Juventus match that I mentioned, where they were the team that blew that lead. So now they're starting to find ways to at least get a draw out of a result that maybe would have been a loss in past seasons, I think. And I think that's what, you know, a winning side needs. And that's what I think what Mourinho is trying to get out of his side.
Yeah, I think that's fair. So let's talk a little bit about the various positions. We're going to start with the defense. I think, look, it's a given that Rui Patricio, I mean, he's had some problems, but he's clearly been a big upgrade. But I want to talk more about the center backs. So rank for me in terms of performance, who do you think has done better this season between Mancini, Ibañez, Kumbula, and Smalling?
Yeah, that's tough because, you know, none of them has been outstanding. They've all had their good matches and they've all had their clunkers. You mentioned Patricio certainly has been an upgrade. I'll just throw that in there. He has very few glaring mistakes, which we've become all too accustomed to the past couple of years under Olsen and Lopez. So he himself has been an upgrade. But the players in front of him, you know, there's some games where you're like, well, Smalling is the most important guy to this defense. They play so much better when he's there. And then he's had a couple of matches where you're like, oh, geez, what is he doing? You know, if I was looking at some of the numbers before I came on just to try to get an idea, because like I said, nobody has stood out to me. Ibanez's numbers tend to be the best. So if you're looking at pure numbers, he's probably been the best. From a leadership perspective, when he is on, I think Smalling is probably the most important one because he's the veteran. He plays the middle of that back three and tends to have the most defensive responsibilities when Ibanez or Mancini will sometimes push up, which they often do since they play the three-man back line. They sometimes will play like an auxiliary like fullback when they are in possession. So I think defensively, he's probably been the most important. So I guess I would give him the nod. Kumbel is interesting because he started very slowly. He was one of those guys that in that Bodo Glimp match really got torn into and was actually sent to the stands for a couple matches. And the thing I like the most about his season is of the guys that were really benched after that match or really put in a poor performance, he's the one that has kind of taken the bull by the horns, taken as a learning experience and really started to improve the past couple months. You know, he's been very important. He was very good in the Atalanta match when Ibanez was out. So I've been impressed with him. So he's certainly starting to trend upwards and maybe start to play up to that price tag that Roma bought him for a couple seasons ago. Mancini, I've always had a soft spot for. You know, he's now become the vice captain of the side. His biggest flaw, which kind of pulls him back for me, is he just takes too many yellow cards. And this is a player I really like. I was hopeful that he might eventually break into the Italy side with Bonucci and Chiellini getting older and a little more injury prone. But he just will tend to make those mistakes. Sometimes the fire is there, which I think is what Mourinho loves about him. But I guess with all that being said, if I had to rate them in order, I would probably go Smalling one, Ibanez two, Mancini three, and Kumbula fourth, just because Kumbula has been a smaller sample size of good performances. But, you know, I still have a lot of hope with three of those four being on the younger side for defenders. And, you know, Kumbula, I think, is still 22, maybe 23. So he's still got a very high potential. So does Ibanez. I think Mancini is what he is at this point. He needs someone maybe a little bit of a cleaner defender next to him, you know, kind of like that Mexes Juan pairing Roma had back when I started following the side back in the early 2000s, mid 2000s, where Juan was that clean, steady defender and Mexes, you know, could have a little bit of a hothead sometimes and maybe it was a little reckless once in a while, but they've kind of fit together well. And I think Mancini can fill that role if, you know, Kumbula or Ibanez can become the other side of that pairing if they do go to a 4-2, you know, 3-1 like Mourinho likes next season.
Yeah, I know it pained you to put Mancini there. I know it did. And yeah, I'm with you. I have high hopes for Kumbula. You know, I wonder, we've seen some Verona players, you know, from Juric, which is a little bit like Gasperini, take them out of the system. They struggle. But I still think Kumbula can be revived. Speaking of revivals, you know, there were questions on Mourinho and Mkhitaryan being reunited. I thought Mkhitaryan got off to a really slow start to the season, but he's really come on strong. People may kind of forget that this time last season, I mean, Mkhitaryan was like an outside candidate for MVP in Serie A. He was really, really awesome. So are you surprised that Mkhitaryan has gotten back into gear, and how much has that helped Roma?
Yeah, so he actually has become very important in the last couple weeks, especially for a reason probably nobody expected. You know, when Mourinho came over, a lot of people thought he might be a candidate to leave just because from what I read and, you know, gathered, his relationship with Mourinho wasn't the greatest at United toward the end. But he, you know, stuck it out and he's, like you said, started slowly, but he's coming around. And the position he's come around in the past couple of weeks where he has been really good is actually as kind of like a, you know, like not a true defensive midfielder, but kind of playing that utility midfield role where he's doing a lot of the dirty work. He actually, against Atalanta, I remember I did a stats piece after that match for Chiesi Totti, and I was looking at some of the numbers, and I was shocked when I saw he had 19 ball recoveries and Roma had 78 as a team. You know, this is a guy who's known as an attacking midfield type player, can play in the hole behind the strikers and really create and score some goals himself. And he's really putting in really solid all around performances so far. So I'm not surprised he's kind of had a revival of late, but I'm surprised in the way he's done it and where he's made himself useful to the side. And, you know, I it's been so important for Roma. Like I said, in that 1-0 Atalanta win, which really Atalanta is the only top Serie A side they've beaten this year outside of Fiorentina in the first week, which at that time, nobody was looking at Fiorentina as like a European threat. He was just huge in that match. He was man of the match. So yeah, definitely surprised by the way he's revived himself.
Yeah, he's been incredibly important. So I'm going to ask you about Oliveira, who was, you know, the pretty significant January addition. I would say maybe after Vlahovic, maybe as big, you know, not comparable to Vlahovic, but a pretty significant addition. Not the youngest player. He's had his moments. How do you feel about his performances so far? And do you see him as someone that can help Roma in the next year or two?
Yeah, so I think he started really well. I can see why Mourinho wanted him in the side, veteran type midfielder. He knows his, you know, he knows his position. He's positionally good. He's kind of cooled recently, but he did have the only goal in that Conference League first leg victory against Vitesse last week. I missed the game, so I didn't get to see how his overall performance was. Did eventually get red carded, so he's missing out today. But I do see him as a player who will be part of the future. He has an option. I think it's for about 14 million euros. You know, Mourinho's going to want a veteran around that he can trust. You can see he clearly didn't trust Diawara, VR. He didn't like these players. That's why VR is going and Diawara is not playing much. So I expect him to stick around. Do I think he'll be a clear-cut starter next season? I don't think so, but I do think he'll be an important part of a rotation where hopefully they bring in a defensive midfielder who's a true defensive midfielder. You know, I think Cristante is a guy Mourinho likes, even though he takes a lot of criticism. He could be part of that rotation with Oliveira and, you know, maybe Mkhitaryan plays a little more in that central midfield role like he is now. I think Vertu's the one who's probably gone at the expense of the defensive midfielder and Oliveira sticks around.
Very interesting. So let's get to the attack and the exciting part of Roma. And look, you know, I get that Zeko, especially last season, he really needed some new motivations, but I think Zeko overall was a really, really good Roma player. But I totally get how this version of Tammy this season is a massive upgrade from what Roma was getting last season. So what has been for you your favorite thing about watching Tammy at Roma?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a great upgrade for Roma, and that's no disrespect to Dzeko. Like you said, he was great for Roma, his career, you know, in the capital. I think ended up the third leading goal scorer all time, somewhere around there. So over 100 goals. You can't scoff at that. But for the people who, when they made the move for Tammy and Dzeko decided to leave, were upset that Dzeko left thinking he'd be more productive and then are seeing him at Inter and say, oh, he's got X amount of goals. He wouldn't be doing that at Roma right now. He can't do what Tammy does for the team right now.
Without a doubt.
Yeah, Tammy has been so impressive to me because I didn't get to see much of him at Chelsea. I don't watch a whole lot of, you know, Chelsea, and then, you know, Giroud got a lot of the starts at striker too through the years, and Tammy was kind of like that second player, which is why he left, right, when Lukaku arrived. His all-around game is really good. He's quick with the ball, quick off the ball, makes good runs. He's had a few assists that was in the first couple matches, surprised me the most was he actually assisted a couple goals. I think one was Ferver too, and one was maybe for Mkhitaryan or Pellegrini, where you're like, wow, he can pass the ball too. And his hold up play is pretty good for a guy who's a bit gangly. You know, he's tall and lanky. And obviously the goal scoring has been there. He's got 20 goals in all competitions so far. And with some better luck, he'd probably be somewhere around 25 because he's hit quite a few posts this year. Really growing as a player. You can tell he loves to be in the capital. He's out there, you know, singing with the curva when he's out there. And he's really, for a guy who many questioned whether he even wanted to come to Serie A, because he was linked with Atalanta first, yeah. When Zapata was linked with Inter originally. They're like, well, why would he want to leave England and leave Chelsea? These English players don't want to come abroad. He's embraced the experience and he's become an important player. You know, he's definitely here for next season. Hopefully after that, Chelsea doesn't, enact the option they have, but if they do, it's an 80 million euro option and Roma paid 40. It's a nice hefty profit. So it's good business either way, but I've been very impressed with him. I love what he does. The partnership with Zaniolo is really growing in my opinion. And with Pellegrini feeding them balls, I've hoped that next season, the attack will be even more productive.
Yeah, Tammy is fantastic. I went to one Chelsea game in person and he started and I was blown away. Man, I had forgotten that he was so heavily linked to Atalanta. Man, that's a huge what if now. It would have changed a lot. He's been awesome at Roma. There is no doubt about it. And it's great, as you said, he's embraced the city. I don't think there's a better place in Serie A when things are going well, either for the team or you individually. So it's good that he's enjoying it. So last question on Roma before I ask you who you think is going to win the Scudetto is, of course, on Zaniolo. A lot's been made about him. Got off to a slow start, which was understandable considering the knee injury he recovered from. So what do you make of Zaniolo this season? Are you happy with what you've seen so far?
Yeah, so like you said, he's coming back from his second ACL, didn't play at all last season. So, you know, I think expectations had to be tampered a bit. And I think he's still really truly recovering from that injury. I still don't think he's fully back yet. You know, he's not the Zaniolo we saw pre-injury. You know, you can't look at just pure numbers, in my opinion, because he's only got 2 goals in Serie A so far. You know, he had he was never a huge goal scorer in Serie A before that. He had, you know, 6 the season before he got injured. Again, it was an injury shortened season in similar amount of minutes and 4 the one before that. So but what he does well is run at players. He gives Roma another option in the attack to kind of put defense on their heels. Has he been great? No. You know, if I had to rate his season, it's probably more of like, I don't know, out of a scale of 10, somewhere in like the 7 range. He certainly hasn't been in the 8-9 range like you would rate like Pellegrini and Abraham this season for what they've contributed. But he's still young. And the one thing that I know frustrates him, because you see it all the time in the pitches, he doesn't get the respect of other players when he does get hacked and you know, brought down and kicked a bit. The calls that other players would probably get, he doesn't get, which I think, you know, is part of the reason why he's had a frustrating season for himself personally, because then he gets, I think, taken off his game a bit. You can see he mouths off the refs a little bit, which is something he's going to have to, you know, channel a little bit, because you're not going to make any more friends by doing that. You're not going to get any more calls by doing that. And I think the maturity has to come a little bit more with him. I think once he matures a little bit, I think we're going to start to see the Zaniolo, because I think the physical attributes are still there. You know, he's still got the explosiveness. He can still, I think, become a really good player for both Roma and Italy. And, you know, with Chiesa out now and Insigne a bit out of form and heading to Toronto, I think his time could come sooner rather than later for the Azzurri if, you know, they're going to qualify for the World Cup. So I think the potential's there. And I think the managers see it, which is why he plays almost every match still, even if his production hasn't been what you might have expected it to be.
Okay, well said. Okay, before I let you go, and if you guys want to read more Roma, hear more, definitely check out Chiesa di Totti, a great place. So I want to ask you this. Roma technically, mathematically, can still win, but you know, I think here you're a little bit of a neutral. So let me ask you this, going into this weekend, who do you think is going to win the Scudetto?
So it's been kind of like a revolving door, right, at the top of the table with Milan, Inter, and AC Milan. And, you know, if you asked me a couple of weeks ago, I would have said I think Inter would win. You know, heading into the derby, I guess that was about 5-6 weeks ago up in Milan, I thought if Inter won, they were going to run away with the Scudetto, and they didn't. Giroud had that brace that saved Milan's Scudetto hopes, and now Inter's really struggling. And I'm starting to think that after the past couple of weeks' results, Milan is kind of in the driver's seat, which I never thought I would say, because I think squad-wise, I think out of those three teams, they probably have the weakest squad, I think, but they're getting results. And I think right now, if I had to, you know, put a wager on it, so to speak, I guess I would have to pick Milan, because Inter, like I said, underwhelming. Napoli had a couple chances a couple weeks ago to really kind of pull away, and they let those chances slip away. So, you know, it'll probably change in the next couple weeks based on the way these teams are playing. But right now, I'd have to say Milan.
You know, it's hard to argue. I think if I ask you which team deserves to win the Scudetto the most, whatever that means, it's hard not to pick Milan, also because of how much adversity they've overcome. So, Steve, it was great catching up with you. Thank you so much. It was way too long since I've had you on. Everyone check out Steve's excellent work. I'm sure we'll chat before the season ends. So thanks for doing it. And I look forward to the next one.
Thanks again for having me, David.
always great to hear from Steve. Before we get to the Lazio side of things, we're going to do a part of the pod for our patrons only. If you enjoy the pod, consider becoming a patron. You hear an episode on Tuesday. I actually did two of them while on vacation. I always try to give patrons as much content as I possibly can. You get to ask us questions. We have some awesome articles. We had Enrico Passarella this week with a great article on the best additions from the January window. We have sometimes our friend Frank Risotto with his awesome articles about the useless information from Serie A, which is far from useless. Really great stuff there. Really good community. Great guys. If you're looking to chat calcio with some cool people, that would be a great place to be.
Very excited to welcome the next guest. The reason I say it is, A, he's awesome when it comes to talking about Lazio, but anyone who's been listening to the pod for a very long time remembers Sean McIntosh, as someone that's been, you know, very involved with the fan ticketing side of things here in the U.S., and he's had an amazing journey. So Sean is now like the fan czar, the head of the fan experience for Charlotte FC, the newest MLS team in the U.S. They are off to a fantastic start off the pitch. They'll get some points, I'm sure, soon. So we're going to talk a little bit about that because Sean's work is really, really fascinating. But we also, of course, want to talk about Lazio with the derby coming up. So, Sean, my dear friend, it's a real pleasure to have you back on. Bentornato to Calcioland.
Thank you for having me, David. Always fun to talk calcio, especially ahead of the derby. It's been a little bit since you and I have gotten to chat, so excited to do it.
Awesome. Great stuff. So I've been asking this question as we head into the final stretch of the season to our guests. If you had to pick one word to describe Lazio's season so far, what would it be and why?
Man, it's such a good question. And it's so hard. There's two words that really stick out that I can't separate from each other. I'm stuck on the word transition and stuck on the word progress. And they're so linked together because Lazio has been, you know, with the appointment of Sadi, has been in this transitional phase. Everything from formation to how they play to making sure that, you know, they have the right players in place and knowing it'll take a couple transfer markets to do it. You know, it's a club in transition. At the same time, I go back to this progress because it's how we have to measure Lazio right now. And look, points and results, all of that matters and it will never not matter. But I think for me personally, when I evaluate the club and I evaluate this time period that they're in, it's all about transitional progress. Are they making strides to being the club that we want to be under Sadi? Are they playing that Sadi ball? Is it getting a little bit more consistent? Are we seeing players grasp it? Those are the things that I think of when I think about Lazio right now. So
I like it. You cheated. You gave two, but they fit very well together. So let's talk a little bit more about the transition. I feel like both managers in this derby, you know, anytime there's criticism of Mourinho, it's like, well, it's a 3-year plan. As you mentioned, Sarri, big change. Sounds like Lotito really, really likes Sarri. It seems like Sarri is very happy there. So it sounds like that might actually be a long-term marriage. So as you mentioned, it's going to take probably a couple more transfer windows to build the team a little bit more in Sarri's image. But so far, what has stood out to you in the transition from Inzaghi to Sarri?
Yeah, really the biggest thing that has stood out and really what's been both a little bit of a breath of fresh air and an absolute surprise, because I think the knock on both Inzaghi and what the knock has been on with Sadi for so long has been the aversion to rotate, this inability to find a rotation and go to different players and try new things. And, you know, there was a time when I know myself and many Lazzali were really frustrated with the lack of rotation from Cibone. And I think Inter fans are starting to see some of that too. But, you know, what's been really nice is that Sadi has tinkered with the lineup. He's given players opportunities. I think that's one of the biggest things is that he has been open to change and open to giving players opportunities, which has been been really positive for player growth and development. You look at guys like, take Strakosha, for instance. I mean, early in the season, buried in the rotation behind Pepe Reina, he found himself last season with Simone Inzaghi in that same situation. All of a sudden, Strakosha, who had been our number one for a number of years, finds himself behind Pepe Reina, despite, you know, less than stellar performances from Reina, let's say. And I'm being very generous there. But, you know, Strakosha was given the opportunity after a few challenges with Reina and hasn't looked back. And so I find that really positive from Sadi. Another player, Cataldi, who all of a sudden became a big part of this club, finding himself in the starting 11 oftentimes in place of Leiva. And a player like Patrick, who I have been on record slandering, and I'm not his biggest fan. But you have to give credit to Sadi in moments, has given him opportunities to play that center back role and rely on him, you know, in the absence of Acerbi, and he's flourished in those opportunities, played right back this past weekend and did a fine job. So, you know, that's something that I look at, has given, you know, youngsters some opportunities, not as much as we would all love, but you've seen Raul Mora, you've seen Luca Romero making appearances, and just tinkering with the lineup, I think, has been really positive for me.
Great stuff. And yeah, you can also hear Sean chatting Lazio on Lazio World. They do a great job there. So you started talking about the keeper. Let's work our way up. I kind of want to make an assessment on the whole squad. So you mentioned Acerbi. You mentioned Patrick. Acerbi is getting up in age. When you look at Lazio's defense, how many players, or are there even any players you see as guys that you'd want being Lazio's backline for the foreseeable future?
Well, certainly when you talk about the defense, specifically at that center back position, the source of the biggest frustration amongst Laziali for a number of years, honestly, you bang your head against the wall trying to figure out why they don't strengthen that position over the course of a number of transfer markets. But look, there is a bright spot in there. When I look at Luis Felipe, a player that I've been very high on for a number of years. He's still a young player. He's still a player that has room to develop and grow. Look, he's been called up by Mancini he hasn't made that appearance yet, but he's in the mix as part of the Italian national team as a Brazilian. But I think he's a player that has an opportunity long-term, but Lazio, like they do so many times, can be really frustrating when it comes to negotiations. We know Lotito is no easy man to deal with. And they find themselves in a situation very akin to what happened with Stefan de Vrij, where they fail to come to an agreement, take it down to the wire, nickel and dime a little bit, where there's probably a difference of $100,000 or $200,000 in the grand scheme of things. Losing a player like that on a free does more harm than good. So I think, you know, he's certainly a player I think it's imperative to bring on, knowing that we oftentimes find ourselves without the transfers we like. Losing him would put us in a situation where we now need a number of center backs versus finding, you know, maybe one or two. So I think he's a player I'd rely on, I'd keep long term. Acerbi, obviously, still a player that can make an impact, but just up there in age. So yeah, I think it's imperative that they find a way to sign Luis Felipe.
For sure. Okay, let's work our way to the midfield. I want to ask you about Milinkovic-Savic, who's been a protagonist on this podcast dating back to our first show. I have to say, I was very excited to see what Sarri would do with him. I've been pretty excited with some of the results. So what do you make about Milinkovic-Savic's current campaign, and where do you rank it compared to his other seasons at Lazio?
Yeah, I mean, look, if it's not the best campaign to date, it's certainly up there. Look, he finds himself second in Serie A in assists to Berardi. This is the most goal contributions he's had since being at Lazio. You know, in 2017, 2018, he contributed 12 goals. You know, he finds himself at 8 right now, but he's got those 9 assists. And I think what's been incredible is, look, he's a player that I've said can play in a number of different systems, has the ability to play you know, across the midfield, can obviously have strengths in a lot of different areas, change in system, change in formation, style of play. And he's proving to be a world-class impactful player. So for me, this is his standout season among, you know, a number of really, really great seasons. He still comes up with big goals, contributes in a lot of ways. So what's really incredible, and we've talked about some of the challenges with Lotito, is he's happy. He's happy to play for Lazio. He's never made any gripes about wanting that big money move. Certainly the money and the moves are out there if he wants them. But you have to applaud, you know, his leadership, his commitment. And look, if a move is going to come, he's approached it the right way and has done everything on the pitch to earn it. But, you know, player that I'd love to see continue at Lazio for a long, long time.
Yeah, I'll tell you, when we started the pod, Koulibaly, Milinkovic, Savic were huge protagonists, and we've been the pod almost 5 years. Had you told me both would still be at Serie A on their team, I don't think I would have believed it. So,
yeah, me neither.
Yeah, very, very exciting. So let's move our way more up front. You know, Sarri is very well known for his wingers, offensive midfielder type players. I think it's been a little bit of a mixed bag. Milinkovic, Savic been superb. Luis Alberto's had his struggles. So let me ask you this. Let's take Luis Alberto, Zaccagni, who unfortunately is going to miss the derby, has been playing well recently, and Felipe Anderson, who's played a ton this season. Rank them for me in the order you think they've been the most effective.
That's a good question. So I will rank Zaccagni at number one. I would put Luis Alberto at two and Felipe Anderson at three. Now, at his best, Felipe Anderson can be number one. And the struggle and challenge with him is the waves that he plays in. It's a world-class, you know, 20 minutes or a match, if you can get a full match out of him, and then he tends to go invisible. Zaccagni, look, he started off this season slow, was coming off injury. There was frustration with him not seeing the pitch, and certainly, you know, had to adapt and find his way. But he has proven to be a player that is very direct. I love how direct he is. It's something different that he brings. He's always got an eye for goal. He tends to beat his man off the dribble more often than not. He's a strong player. I think he's a player that you'll start to see be brought up when it comes to the Azzurri. I think he's a player that's earning a place, you know, maybe not yet, but at least drawing some attention. Look, I mean, he's played seven fewer games than Luis Alberto, and he has only two fewer assists, and they're level on goals. So, you know, in fewer games, he's made more of an impact than a player like Alberto, who, you know, we know on his day, you know, absolutely, you know, one of the best playmakers in the league. And I still think he's there. It's just, you know, he tends to sprinkle in some games where you don't know whether or not he's on the pitch. And I don't know if he makes a ton of sense in Sadi's system, but he is a player like Luis Alberto is a player that can figure it out. And more often than not, he does. But I would go Zaccagni, who I've been very, very impressed with, Alberto, and then Felipe Anderson, who, you know, started off this season really, really hot. You know, could be said that he was overused. You know, he was up there in minutes when he was able to be rotated a little bit. You saw some of that burst in activity from him again, but a little bit too inconsistent for me.
Yeah, well said there. So let's talk about Immobile. I know it's a player you're particularly passionate about. And look, you know, I think it's very easy if you're not an Immobile Lazio fan to just talk about the Italian national team. I would say maybe it's a little bit unfair. Maybe that's played up a little bit too much. And I think what's been very interesting with him is, and I know Alistair, our friend, wrote about it, and this is something we've been talking about on the pod all season, is that Mancini does run a system pretty similar to Sarri. And Immobile has been really good on Lazio in that system, which I had a question going in. So I know you always make this tweet. So make the case for our listeners as to why Immobile is clearly the most underrated striker, not in Serie A, like in the world right now.
Yeah. Well, look, first I'll say this. While Mancini and Sadi play the same formation, you know, not all 4-3-3s are built the same. So you know, when you think about the Azzurri, the way that those wingers play, those wingers are much more direct. You know, you're looking at Chiesa, you know, finding goals, very direct, attacking defenders. So versus at Lazio, that scheme and that system, you know, is typically in service of Chiro. Chiro running the channels, not just to create space, which is what he does so well for the Azzurri, like, but he's making those runs to find the ball, and those players know, and there's timing involved when to find him, and they do. So look, Mancini himself has come out and has talked about how critical, like, we all know and praise Mancini, right? You know, European champion. We love what he's done. We talk about how great he is as a manager. Yeah, we want to slack off one of his players. But when Mancini says how critical, look, I'm going to continue to start Ciro Immobile because he does X, Y, and Z, we tend to ignore that. But to make the case for, you know, why Ciro to me is the most underrated player in the world, first it starts with, you know, what accolades is he getting? And is he being, you know, quote unquote, hated on? You know, more often than not, you're hearing a lot of negativity about a player who, since joining Lazio in 2016, 2017, has more goals than anybody in the world not named Messi and Lewandowski. He's level with Cristiano Ronaldo. Those three players are three players not just highly regarded in today's game, but when we discuss all-time players, all-time goal scorers, each one of those three are always mentioned. We talk about Ballon d'Or. There's never a conversation without Lewandowski, Messi, and Ronaldo being discussed. You never hear Ciro Immobile. We're talking about a player that was a European Golden Boot winner. Talking about a player in the Serie A landscape, you know, has scored 20 or more goals six times in his career. Only two players have ever done that. Remarkable. A player who is on pace to, you know, things have to go right and he's got to play, but he's on pace to finish in the top three. And if he has a couple more seasons of 30 goals or more, which is pretty realistic, I mean, he could challenge being the all-time leading goal scorer in Serie A. With Piola owning that record, Ciro just became Lazio's all-time goal scorer. So we're talking about a player who can ultimately be a top one to three goal scorer in league history. And with what he's done, you know, and coming up in big moments for Lazio, scoring in Champions League, people like to talk about the challenges that he's had abroad, but when he was with Dortmund, he was scoring in Champions League. When he was with Lazio last season, was scoring in Champions League. So, you know, for me, you know, whether or not you want to rate him as a Ballon d'Or, nobody's asking for that. But, you know, when you talk about him, I think he needs to be talked up there as one of the elite strikers in the world, because the numbers don't lie. And while, you know, he's not scoring at that incredible clip for Italy, which is fair to document, you know, when you look across national teams, not a lot of players tend to score at the clip that they do at club level. You know, certainly we've spoken very highly of players like Luca Toni, who only had two goals in a World Cup campaign. You know, Ciro does the same and looked at very differently in today's age, where, you know, it's quicker to you know, criticize a player on social. So I think a lot of it's very unfair, and you can't hide behind the numbers, and the numbers in terms of what he's doing at the club level are historic.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Very, very well said there. And look, you know, even if you made the argument, okay, the Serie A isn't the one of the past, the fact that he has 20 plus goals is really unbelievable. So yeah, I very well said there. So let's talk a little bit about your job. This is really a fascinating story. I think, you know, if you're looking for a little bit of inspiration, I think this is a great place to check out. So I've known Sean for a while. He's been a guest on the show many times. I've seen him do what in Italy is called the gavetta, like work his way up. I've seen Sean, you know, when I first met him, I think you were working in Vegas on a female WNBA team. You did a great job there. And I think you briefly worked in minor league hockey, if I remember. And then you got this great job at Charlotte FC. For those of you not familiar with this, is the newest MLS franchise. So a huge, huge deal. And you're the chief fan officer there. So tell us a little bit about your role and what is a chief fan officer?
Yeah, well, look, we'll actually, you and I have actually gone back a little bit further than that. We started talking and you know, jumping on your podcast as back as early in, I was with the Houston Dynamo. So even prior to Vegas, I was in Houston.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. And had launched the Texas Laziali fan group there. And so that's where you and I had connected. But look, fortunate enough to be back in the league that I'm really passionate about, growing this sport here in America and in North America. And so I'm in a fortunate position to be here with Charlotte FC, a club that is new to Major League Soccer. We are an expansion team here in Charlotte, North Carolina. And you know, in a position that is the first of its kind across American sports, if not the world. So as a chief fan officer, I am responsible for making sure that our fans are, first of all, listened to, that they are heard. I keep a very tight pulse on the fan sentiment, both on social, both through events that we host, conversations in person, meeting with our supporters. And so understanding what it is that our fans want. And then I work across every department here at the club. I directly report to our president and then on the leadership side, making sure that, you know, everything from marketing to ticket sales to operations to the music we play in our building, all of that resonates with what our fans want. So it's really fun because I get to work across a number of different departments. No day is the same. I work really, really closely with our supporters. So our, you know, our ultras and making sure that, you know, they have what they need from the club. Look, that we know, you know, it's certainly in Serie A, but no different in Major League Soccer. A lot of times there can be tension and really difficult relationships between a club and its supporters or ultras. And for me, I've been keen on making sure that relationship was healthy, that there was an open line of communication, that as their chief fan officer, I found ways to support them in every way possible. So, you know, we didn't have those issues and challenges. And so it's been a lot of fun building what our atmosphere was, working with our entertainment team to create, you know, what we thought was a pretty badass party on March 5th with 74,000 plus in a building. So it's been a lot of fun. It's been challenging, it being the first of its kind, you know, kind of molding this position into something that I want. Based on my skill set, but it's been extremely gratifying.
Incredible. There weren't many stadiums that had more fans the day that you guys launched your first game, right? I think there was like maybe two or three. You guys were attendance.
So we were the high. So first we broke a Major League Soccer record for highest attended MLS game ever. That weekend we were the highest attended soccer match across the globe. And we were the second or third highest attended soccer match this year. So, you know, it was quite a spectacle. We really focused on creating something unique from an entertainment standpoint in game that came to life in a really fun way. And look, it from a career standpoint for me, it was certainly a highlight of, you know, any match that I've worked in my 14-year career. So it was definitely something special. I'm excited to share it with any and everybody that wants to come out to Charlotte, because we're pretty proud of what we're building here. You know, and it's very unique, which we take a lot of pride in.
Absolutely. So I know you did some travels, you visited some stadiums to prepare, to make sure, you know, you had a good frame of reference. So tell us a little bit about this, and were you inspired by anything you saw in Italy, or maybe it was on what not to do?
So, you know, part of early on in my tenure here, yeah, I went across both the United States, had a chance to go to the West Coast to see what, you know, clubs from Major League Soccer that are really well established do, like the Seattle Sounders, the Portland Timbers, who have really great fan support and do some things that, you know, were really great to the soccer culture. Had a chance to go back to Vegas and check out the Las Vegas Raiders in their inaugural season, and then a chance to go out to the Seattle Kraken. You know, so that was important. I went to their first ever game in Seattle, which again, I wanted to take some things and see what they did from commemorating a first match. Went to a Golden Knights game. You know, they do you know, we're big on trying to create a party. That's been a campaign of ours since the beginning. When we were announced that, that Charlotte was getting a club, our owner, Mr. Tepper, announced that this would be a party. There's no better party than in Vegas. So kind of taking some of the things that we saw they did really, really well and leaned into, helped inspire some of what we did. And then had the chance to go out to Rome, to go to a Lazio Juve match. And look, there were certainly things that that they didn't do that we wanted to make sure we did to enhance the experience. Look, we know Italy's behind sometimes when it comes to stadiums, their atmospheres, what they're doing. But there was also a lot of things that they did really well that, you know, while, look, there's a stigma a lot of times amongst MLS fans or older MLS fans that have been around and not just MLS, but people tend to hate change, right? So you do something and people get upset because that's not the traditional way of doing something. And so I think what was cool is that, you know, Lazio does some things using entertainment that weren't necessarily traditional that I thought that they did really, really cool. I mean, they had a guitarist out there, you know, that was part of their ceremony and chants and songs with their supporters pregame that I thought was really cool and unique, that brought some life to some of the traditions. So yeah, they did some things really well, did some things, you know, from a fan experience side. You know, the biggest thing that I kind of laughed at with Vittoria, who we went to the match with from Lazio World and Lazio Lounge, but like their team store is honestly, it's like a cutout. Like they have a shop that half the time isn't open for Lazio matches, which again, you think about from the American.
That would never happen. Like, yeah.
I mean, mind blowing. It happened to be open when we walked in for the match I went to. And I want to say they had like a couple scarves, one employee who was barely working, and you know, maybe one kit for sale. So, you know, it just goes back to the Italian culture, right? Where it's less, you know, sometimes it's good, less capitalistic, but also where they just don't put the fan journey in mind and think about ways to capitalize on people being in their building.
Well, I'm sure you're doing a fantastic job there. Before I let you go, who is your pick to win the Scudetto?
Man, that's your hardest question that you've asked because it probably changes from week to week. Something about this season has me wanting to say it'll be Napoli. If not this year, then when? That would be my gut. And it changes every week. But
they don't win it this season. A season in which they get 1 point at home against Milan and Inter, and it's so tight, and they're still right there. It's like, yep, you really don't want to win it if you're going to do it again.
Yeah, you know, storybook send-off for Insigne, who's coming to Major League Soccer. So, you know, I'll be excited to see him here this summer in Charlotte when Toronto's on the road. But look, I think it would be a storybook ending to kind of finish that cycle with the players that they have. So, you know, I think the storyline's there. My gut tells me that if I had to choose today, I would go with Napoli.
Well, speaking of storylines, Sean, it's been awesome to see your journey. Yeah, we've known each other so long, I had forgotten about the Houston Dynamo family. What you're doing is awesome. I know this is a lifetime. You've worked for this, so very well done. You're a great guy. You always treat people with respect, so I'm very happy to see you succeed. So definitely, everyone, if you're in the U.S., try to hit up a game in Charlotte. I'm definitely going to go soon. If you want more Lazio content, definitely check out Lazio World of Vittorio. Sean and gang do a great job. So thanks so much for doing it, my friend. Look forward to seeing you in Charlotte and chatting calcio again real soon.
Thanks, David. Appreciate it.
All right, let's close the podcast on the Batman. Alex doesn't want any spoilers, so he took his headset off. I'm not going to do spoilers, but I will talk a little bit about the vibe of the movie. So I actually went to London. My sister invited me to go see it. It was though the first night I was there, and I was like, you know what? I'm not sitting through a three-hour movie the first night I'm there. So I didn't see it. It was on my list. I headed out to see it yesterday on St. Paddy Day in Boston. So I didn't read too much about it. Obviously, I knew of the cast. So I'll tell you this. I liked it a lot more than I thought I would. I very often talk on the pod how very often we've already made up our minds if we're going to like something or not. I'm not saying that I went in wanting it to suck, but it really did impress me. What I liked about it is this was, they really tried to be pretty different from the Tim Burton one. So the one with Michael Keaton and Jack Nicholson and the Nolan one, which to me are really the iconic Batman. They tried to be very different and they went full Fincher. Like, this movie is much more inspired by Seven than any previous Batman. There are quite a few nods to Seven. I think they really kind of wanted to say, hey, this is kind of a little bit of a tribute to Seven, kind of in a way how Dark Knight is a little bit of a tribute to Heat, although you might not realize it in the moment. But this one, they made it very obvious. I think even they made this kind of into a detective story, which I really like. So they changed the kind of scope of the movie, and even the two protagonists, you know, Robert Pattinson and Jeffrey Wright, it was a little bit reminiscent of Brad Pitt, Morgan Freeman in Seven. There were definitely a few other few nods to that. So I thought that was extremely well played. I thought the cast was interesting. I can't really put my finger on if I can say that I really liked them per se, but I'll give you a few thoughts. Paul Dano, who's the main villain, he's an actor that I've always found myself wanting to really like. He was in a lot of, I forget what the first movie he was in that made him famous, and then he was in There Will Be Blood, where he's opposite Daniel Day-Lewis. And I thought this role was pretty similar to that. It also had invoked a little bit Kevin Spacey from Seven. So I can't say if I really loved Paul Dano or not, but it definitely was an interesting performance. I thought Colin Farrell, very interesting at the Penguin. You can barely recognize him. Zoe Kravitz, very, very attractive. Is she a great actress? Probably not, but she pulled off Catwoman really well. As far as Robert Pattinson, I didn't mind him as a Batman. I thought was fine, maybe not the most engaging. Bruce Wayne looked a little bit like Colin Greenwood from Radiohead if he was better looking. He kind of went with that look. The last thought I have on the movie is the Nirvana song that played a few times. I don't know how I feel about it. I don't know how Kurt Cobain would feel about that song being used twice in the movie, but at least they picked a good one there. Before we end, you know, so I want to give a plug to my friends in Ministry, a band that I really like. We talk about Batman, how they kind of tried to go a different route from an original. And, you know, I'm a huge Ministry fan. When people tell me, you know, what's a band not that many people like that they should get into, they are way at the top of my list. You know, Al Jorgensen, their leader, has been often imitated. Rob Zombie pretty much stole his character, his persona. Fred Durst, Limp Bizkit, paid a fortune for his voice effects, kind of stole to the stage setup. So I got to see Ministry on Tuesday live. It was awesome. I was on the fence on going since I'd seen him a bunch of times, and I was just back from London, and it was awesome. It was a great show. Really, really enjoyed it. They are touring the US now. I feel like some bands are made to play like arenas. I think like Tool, U2, bands like that are great for big venues. I've seen Ministry in arena, not very good. In a club, fantastic. So check it out. So I want to thank you guys for listening to Pod. If you enjoyed it, consider becoming a patron. If not, please leave us a review on iTunes. I read them all. We really do appreciate it. Please leave us 5 stars. You can also leave us 5 stars on Spotify. You know, I certainly don't do this show for the money. I really enjoy doing it. I do put a lot of effort in it. So if you do enjoy the pod, please spread the word and look forward to chatting with you next week.